bear with me for the first 10 minutes or so until we kind of get into it on the basis of what we talked about last night. And then let's play it informally. We're a small enough group that you can stop and say, hey. And I may say, hold, stay with me a few minutes because we're going to get to that, or we may have to stop and deal with it right there. First thing, I put a couple things up here on the board that are basic assumptions or premise from which I've operated and have come to operate, you know, with a new kind of consciousness, I guess. The first one is that God's alive and well and at work in God's world, about the business of being God, whatever that means to you or to me. It's a very broad and kind of elusive statement, but to me that's become very critical and very important to realize that again, to realize it anew and in new and different ways. And then I've got the three points that I mentioned last night in abbreviation somewhat. The first is that something's going on. Two, everybody has to be someplace. And three, that's the abbreviation, that what you do may not be as important as what you do while you're doing it, and that's what may make the difference. And I'll refer back to those three little statements from time to time as we go along, because I think they're probably places where they'll fit. Now I'd like to also to just sort of set a cradle or a framework for the things that I want to talk about this morning and tomorrow too. I'd like to just put a couple of diagrams up on the board that are descriptive of U.S. culture pretty much, or Western culture. Now let me do them very quickly. One looks like this. Really it's a line that could go ad infinitum in any direction with vertical parameters or walls. And I think very much our society has divided itself into little segments or places where things happen, things take place, where struggles exist, and so on and so forth. You can apply it to disciplines, you can apply it to the whole social... I'll sit down and try and point so I can see your faces a little bit. You can apply it to disciplines, or you could apply it to the overall cultural scene. You can apply it to the classifications within our culture. Let me just run a couple by you. Take the one in medicine, for example. You have psychiatry, and you have, if you go to a medical school, I've been around some of those, you have family practice, you have internal medicine, you have physical medicine, rehabilitation, you have surgery, you have, you know, you name it. And everybody has to function in that kind of a structure inside of their category. And doctors do their referrals across the categories, but don't get messed up in other people's bailaway. Everything's in neat categories and divided up. Or on a cultural basis, pretty much, in terms of the human struggles that take place, you've got one for men, one for women, one for youth, one for age, one for straight, one for gay, one for you name it. You know, you just keep bingity, bingity, bing. And very often you find out that a lot of the energy is spent. Youth are fighting the aged, or the middle-aged, whatever you want to say. The gay are fighting the straight, the black fights the white, the red fights the black. You find all these struggles taking place very much on this kind of a level. But it's important. Everybody has to be someplace. It seems as though that there's a place where everybody seems to fit in the structure of our society. Okay. One of the problems that I've been able to observe with white middle class America is that we don't have a place in the struggle. I'm not saying that these struggles, we can talk about that later. Let's forget the little arrows for right now. But pretty much white middle America, and particularly white middle Christian church, kind of lives in a little circle up here, it seems, and looks down at a lot of the struggles that are taking place in a lot of these categories across society, rich, poor, black, white, et cetera, et cetera. Look at a lot of these struggles and don't have much of a way of relating to what's going on.
Yeah.
Those are the categories.
Yeah. When you say they look down at, do you mean in the sense like snub the nose at it, or they just they don't relate to it? I don't understand what you mean.
Both.
Okay.
In the sense, we look down at it in the sense that we snub our nose at it in the sense that we think by studying everything that's going on in all these categories, we can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, we kind of look down at it, that we're the fixers. And particularly, it comes across that if we're Christians, we're God's fixers. And we're going to fix it for God, okay? We're going to missionize, we're going to take care of the et cetera, that's going on. So, therefore, we very often study all that's going on in these categories. We find out what their needs are. Most of what happens in the church are studies of needs. And then we design a project to meet the needs. Okay, and the problem is that we ourselves don't know where we fit in the community of the global village, so to speak, or in the massive struggles that go on against something that's bigger than we are. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. Okay, just that kind of a quickie, just to give you that one way of looking how things seem to be broken up into these categories. And one of the tough things is that so much of the struggle is going on a horizontal level instead of in concert against the forces that press down. Okay, so that we wear ourselves out fighting against each other, and guess who wins, you know? It's the real force that comes from there. We'll talk about what some of that might be after a while. And Friday night, we might even give you a good solid example of the epitomization of that when we use the film. Okay, one diagram. Another one is kind of a class structure ladder. This little piece, I'm going to take from some of my notes that I got from, took from a study that was done by the Urban Studies Program for Colleges of the Midwest in Chicago. Any of you know they did a little social analysis. I want to do this very quickly, too. Society, generally, that box is a little bit big, let's make it about like that, looks something like this, see the little border of boxes. The bottom part is about 15%, and the bottom 15% could be described as the underclass, or the permanently poor. Now we're talking pretty much here about economic structure as well as social structure. There's no way for these people on the bottom to get out of this box. It's important that they stay there. There's no way to make them workers. These people are all on welfare. The welfare market, as it expands, makes them clients of everybody up here in these boxes. We become aware of the great deficiencies down here. Here again, we study these deficiencies so we can take care of it. We've got HUD, Housing Urban Development Program, Health and Welfare, HEW, Health Education and Welfare, fantastic offices in the government, the social service agencies that are expanded across the country. Nearly every state where there's any Lutherans, we have a Lutheran social service agency that seeks to take care of that. A lot of service goes to take care of these clients. We find out about their racial deficiencies. We find out about their community deficiencies. We find out about their job deficiencies. All those kinds of deficiencies are down here. And these are the clients that much of these on the top, that rest on top of them, perform. But they are important that they're there, okay?
Now you're limiting this particular thing just to the United States. Right?
Yeah, I'm talking about our culture, and we'll talk a little more global a little bit later. But there's a parallel.
Yeah,
there's a
right.
parallel.
Yeah.
In fact, the proportions are much different on a global scale because the bottom layer gets very, very huge. This group here probably makes up about 55% of the population, and these could be described as the near poor people.
These are the people who, if they miss one or two paychecks in a row, would drop into the bottom category. Or if everybody came to collect their bills all at one time from all the department stores, et cetera, and their mortgage on the house, et cetera, they would be broke immediately. Or maybe you have one catastrophic disease that takes place and you go to the hospital for 2 or 3 weeks or more, and you don't have at least $10,000 in the bank, you're in deep trouble financially, or some kind of insurance system to take care of it. These are your blue-collar, your lower white-collar people, and the working poor. Advanced capitalist society of which we're a part provides these people with the capacity to be heavy consumers and heavy, hard workers. People here work, usually the goal for work is to gather together things, to have a lot of things. They provide status in the society. They also then provide an opportunity. If you work hard enough, you get a vacation and you got money to spend, you spend it on leisure. So we get involved in the work hard, consume a lot of stuff, gather a lot of material goods, and have some leisure. They work for leisure, they work for status. Whether it's a big car, you know, lots of nice things and trinkets around the house, etc. Parallel to this for me, right now, it's you've been up here all winter, but I'm sure you're aware of it, that you can buy beer cheaper than you can buy soda pop in cans, at least in Minnesota these days. If you buy the right kind of beer, right, a six-pack of Coke and a six-pack of Hohenstein don't even compare. In terms of what I'm trying to say here is that a little drugs here helps, and they got to be kept cheap so we can stay entertained. The role of television sets in Minnesota right now, we're discussing the Dome Stadium and how important that is. All those kind of things is to keep pro football, everything up front for us to keep this kind of occupational thing going. Okay, the next little group here is about 25%. And that's advanced capitalism's carrot that we hold out to the rest of the world. These are the mass media people, highly mobile people. They're very much atomized, individualized. We get around. We can be a lot of places. Personal fulfillment's important. Very competitive. And the idea is that if you can make it to here and maintain it here, that you will be happy. And everybody can get up here into this top 25%, or this 25%, if we just work hard enough and long enough. Now, the truth of the matter is, however, we find out that this really doesn't work for the 25%. They're not really happy with all of that. It has some missing, very important missing pieces, such as depth, faith, community, meaning, those kinds of things seem to be missing out of there. And then there's the top 2 to 5% up here. Call these the biggies. The 2 to 5% are the Rockefellers and the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who have lots of money. They have a tremendous amount of faith in this kind of a system, how it operates, what it's all about. Like the 15% here at the bottom, these people have something in common, and that is both of them know what's going on and what's happening to them. See, something's going on. And these know what's at least going on with their own lives. They have an immense ability to adapt, to change, and immense faith in that kind of arrangement or of a system. These people up here on top just adjust. They have a lot of cushion, a lot of fat to adjust with. They never do the knee-jerk reaction kind of a thing to anything. They just simply give in here and give in there. It's sort of like an amoeba that can kind of move around and stay on top. Now, I think I'm probably right here on the category between the working poor and the top and the 25%, chiefly because of my mobility. Here I am in Holden. I'll be here for 4 days this week and be back in Minneapolis next week. Who knows, I may be in Washington, D.C. before the week is out, et cetera. I can get around, I can see a lot of people do a lot of things, pretty good salary. However, I'm also aware of one or two paycheck failures, and I'm in the relief lines, where most of us might be. But very much, let's take the American Lutheran Church as a general kind of constituency. We're very much in the servicing sector, in the serving society. We do it through our agencies and through our institutions and so on and so forth. That's how we find some value in our life. We dole out survival in behalf of the people at the top to those down here at the bottom. We're concerned for them. We pray for them. We do all kinds of things for them. But down inside, there's a kind of a flowing deep discontent or discomfort with the business of running poverty.
The business of what?
Running poverty.
Running.
Yeah, the business of poverty. We, particularly if we can't find human community in these kinds of levels. We're not with the poor, and very much we're really not with each other. I think what's happening here in your winter community is a good example of attempt, you know, working at being with one another, understanding what that's about and what community is or what it means. Find it very difficult, however, when we get out into the regular society to cross these cultural lines, pretty much locked into them, wherever we are. And it's it seems to me, you know, that we need to find room, let me say a little bit more first. That this whole thing seems to be held together by our institutions, let me say that. Educational institution, the church, all reinforce our schooling, all those things seem to reinforce this kind of a layered structure. And one of the things that's happening that's caused a lot of discontent in these days is the fact that some of these bands that hold this whole thing together are getting shakier, which has caused a move to the right toward conservatism, toward people to really kind of hold on to things the way they are, not to let them be upset too much, not to...
Even though it's fallen apart for a reason.
Yeah, even though it's fallen apart for a reason, we really don't want to believe
that it's wrong.
That's going on. Yeah, that is happening. That it's happening. So we know some things up here at... with some kind of knowledge that we can rationalize and say, yep, in order to keep things together, in order to progress, in order to do this, in order to produce, in order to do all those things, we know that this has got to happen and be done. At another level, at a deeper level, maybe even unconscious for many of us, something's wrong. We know something's wrong. We've got an itch we can't scratch. We don't quite
want to
sure.
Acknowledge it.
And it's very difficult to acknowledge or to surface or to get up there. Okay? That's just a little bit of a framework to put some things in. I want to tell you a little story about a group I talked a little bit about last night. That incidentally, we talked last night. John read a laundry list of kinds of things that Discovering Ministry was involved in, and I see them in these same kinds of struggles. Okay, these are all struggles. And what I want to talk about is that after having kind of seen these things as various struggles, I've come to understand the importance of the interconnectedness of all of this and the importance of trying to find a place where we are, you know, alongside of all this, where everybody's got to be someplace. Where is that place? How do we locate it? How do we find it? And that's what I want to get at. The story is about the group of people about 4 or 5 years ago in Minneapolis that got together. It started out of the sexuality program that we were doing at the medical school at the university, where we suddenly realized that what was happening to people after they experienced that program, that some very good things were happening to us, and that we were dealing with some stuff that was more powerful and was stronger than we knew what we were dealing with. Okay. Changes were happening in the way they saw things, the way they related to each other, as husband, wife, spouse, whatever. People had come there from some of our social service agencies, going back to work in that social service agency, and I remember particularly one letter that sort of ignited a lot of thought and conversation, was from a personnel director, I think it was an LSS of Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, some of you said you were from Wisconsin, who said, we know that it was important to talk to people about sexuality, et cetera, et cetera, because these people deal with people who have sexual problems and need to do all that, but what in the world did you do that changed our people so much? You know, something was going on, back to something's going on up here. What it was just a kind of a thing that steered us into the question about what in the world is going on? Not just with sexuality, but it got us to raising bigger questions about what's going on in lots of places and in lots of ways with lots of things. So we found some other people at the medical school and from other disciplines. We found a quantum physicist, who was saying, yeah, I think I understand what you're talking about. We found the curriculum coordinator at the medical school. We found an artist or two. We had three or four from the National Church Office that were interested in what we were talking about. So we began to meet on a regular basis. Then we met about once a month for an evening, maybe for 2.5 to 3 years. And we talked to a lot of people. Now, one of the things that one of our members, the physicist, of all things, you know, talk about, this was getting kind of spooky because what was going on wasn't something that you could put your finger on very definitely. We called it, there's some kind of energy working here and we don't know what that's all about. What do you mean by energy? I don't know what I mean by energy. What do you mean by energy? But there was an energy flow. There was some kind of something happening that we couldn't define very clearly. The physicist reminded us, and what I'm going to say in the next 2 or 3 minutes, don't pay a lot of attention to it, except be confused by it, because we were too, okay? But I want you to be confused. Tom said, certain assumptions of Einstein's principle of relativity are, 1, the laws of nature are the same for all observers, regardless of their state of motion. Isn't that exciting? And 2, the velocity of light is the same for all observers. That, you know, here we are sitting there, well, that's fine, Tom, you know, now what? But he pointed out that Einstein saw this meant that two different observers make different separations of space and time into spatial and temporal parts. Stay confused. This previously unsuspected common ground of space and time revealed Einstein's relativity fuse into a more objective order of nature called space-time. Okay. Now, we got to pressing Tom on this, and we got to talking this out with each other, and the implication of these realities, though they were confusing for a lot of us, we were church people, you know, didn't take anything past freshman chemistry and biology, began to raise the whole question of our understanding of past and future, here and now, of cause and effect, that things happen because something caused it and therefore there's a certain effect that takes place, and our whole understanding of what history was. Okay? Now, that's okay to be confused at this point. I'm not going to try to explain to you all about that because I can't, you know. I'm not that smart. But since some of us at least held some advanced degrees in theology, we sat down and we talked and we struggled with this, and we began to realize that the implication of all this for the very roots out of which we came were absolutely mind-boggling. Okay, we said, my gosh, you know, if this is right, you know, where be we? All right. Then Lutheran Council USA called a conference a year ago last fall in Kansas City. It was called Mandates for Mission, and they had all the mission directors talk about what their plans were for mission in America from Missouri Synod and from ALC and LCA and AELC. I get all the initials mixed up. Now we're getting to be so many of us, or at least in so many pieces. And Harmon said, Willis Harmon was one of the speakers there. And Willis Harmon is the director of the social policy studies piece of the Stanford Research Institute in California. He's an electronic engineer. And Harmon, let me read a quote from it. He said, we're possibly going through the reestablishment of a balance of two kinds of knowledge. a balance between the objective and the knowledge represented in the humanities. The objective kind of knowledge, you can say, yep, there it is, and we can be objective about it, we can look at it, and that's the object, and we know all about that. That's one kind of knowledge, and our whole society, our culture, our church, everything has been based on that kind of understanding of reality. All our doctrinal systems are built pretty much on that kind of knowledge. We can be objective about it. We can say, now don't get all your emotions mixed up in this. We want to be objective, etc. So we back off and take a look at it. And he's saying that there's a balance between that kind of knowledge and the knowledge that's available, he said, in the humanities. He's talking about that other whole side of us. There's a kind of a balance, a transformation or a shift taking place. Such a balance, I'm still quoting him, will pay some attention to non-material aspects and to value commitments. Our wholeness is somehow involved in this balance as individuals and as a society. The whole of scientific and theological systems are going to be driven back to their roots as this takes place. And he indicated that, quote, theologians and scientists often become angry in the face of this because they think they've already been there. In other words, he's suggesting we're going to be going back deeper to examine some things than we have ever thought we'd have to go. Okay? Now, this is out of Stanford Research Institute. Harman's directed that for about 12 years, and it's from a hard science mindset. Okay, from a hard science mindset, electronical engineering, written textbooks and all that sort of thing.
Isn't he also the one who says we have had a scientification of our...
Scientification of knowledge. Yes.
Yeah.
We've had the scientification of knowledge, and that's about to break down. Okay? Now, when we talked about what Willis Harman had to say in our group, we felt that we had some kind of inkling, you know, about what he was talking about. Okay? Then, you know, you start reading just everything you can get your hands on. And I ran into an article in the Occasional Bulletin, which is the Overseas Ministry Study Center production out of New Jersey. And there was an article there by Vine Deloria Jr. who wrote on Native American perspectives on liberation. Do you know the name Vine Deloria? Was it God is Red and Custer Died for Your Sins? And
We Talk, You Listen.
Vine Deloria is Lutheran, incidentally. He's a graduate with his master's degree from Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, and he's also got a degree in law. And he's now teaching in Tucson at the University of Arizona, and he's teaching on, he's pursuing the whole business of Indian rights.
Is he Indian?
He's Indian, yeah, he's an Indian. Okay, so Vine writes this in there. If we talk seriously about the necessity of liberation, we're talking about the destruction of a whole complex of Western, now get this, a whole destruction of a complex of Western theories of knowledge and the construction of a new and more comprehensive synthesis of human knowledge and experience. He said, when we talk about liberation among the Indians, he said, what we're talking about is Western theories of knowledge are going to fall apart.
And what do people mean when they say Western?
Okay, it's cause and effect. Let me quote him a little further, and I think he'll describe it. If it doesn't, we can talk about it. It's the manner in which people conceive reality that motivates them to behave in certain ways, that provides them with a system of values, enables them to justify their activities. A new picture of reality, a reality conceived as a vision, and not a series of related or connected ideas, he's talking about ministry, can accomplish perhaps even more than keep working away at short-term remedies. Fundamental changes initiated by a new picture of reality will create a transformation and will avoid the traditional replacement of words with new words. In summary, he says, we now challenge the basic assumptions of Western humanity, to wit. And he's got about 8 or 9 listed here, but let me just mention 3 or 4. One, that time is uniform and continuous. What was Tom Etter saying about space and time and history and the past and the future, this physicist? And here, coming out of the Bulletin, Overseas Missionary Bulletin, is an Indian talking about that
time is no longer can be seen as uniform and continuous. You know, ding, 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 the old bell start to ring and say, something's going on someplace, you know. It's coming out of a couple diverse categories. That the world can be divided into subjective and objective, that you can take and say, now this is an objective point of view and here's a subjective point of view, and we can take a look at that and do that. That our descriptions of nature are absolute knowledge, or that inductive and deductive reasoning are the primary tools for gaining knowledge. Bell started to ring as to what that was all about. In fact, I took what Delorius wrote and sent it to Harmon and said, hey, have you seen what this Indian's saying over here? And he was intrigued by it. And then further, some of you, there's a Minnesota group here, you know about McAllister College. McAllister College has the Hubert Humphrey Lectures there in the spring of every year that take place for 6 weeks. And their guest lecturer was a Austrian physicist by the name of Fritjof Capra, who now is doing research and teaching at University of California, Berkeley, in the Berkeley Physics Labs there. He wrote the book The Tao of Physics, which John mentioned last night. He was a friend of Tom Edders, the guy who'd been in our group, and he said, come on, Jim, you got to come over and hear what Copper's got to say, because I think it'd be interesting to you. And I went and spent some evenings together with him. But Copper said stuff like this. Here's a quote. It'll require a different... Okay, let me find it. In discussing the new physics and its social implications, Copper said, it'll require a different social system. We must go through profound value changes in our political, economic, and social systems. The 20th century quantum mechanics has transcended Newtonian cause and effect reductionistic physics. That is, it breaks everything down to its smallest parts. And we think we understand more about reality when we understand the smallest piece of it. To a holistic view of the universe, humankind included as a part of the whole. No longer do we think we always understand things better when they've been explained in terms of or reduced to their elements. It is this way of thinking that gave birth to cause and effect reasoning, which in turn gave birth to a certain kind of determination that had its value in the myth that it enables one to both predict and control reality. It is the stuff that Western thought, including our theological systems, is made out of. That we figured it all out by cause and effect. Well, you start thinking about it. Okay, a theological system? Yeah. For some reason, God made a world. And you can put anything you want in there, and you can start to build from that. He did it because he was lonely. He did it because... He thought there ought to be one. He did it, begins to raise some pretty ultimate questions. You know, what in the world was God up to when he did all that? He put people on it, and then people tried to be God, like he was God, and God didn't like that. See, there's the cause, then there was the effect. God didn't like that, and therefore he drove them out of paradise, out of Eden. They had to pay a price, and therefore God loved man so much that the only way he could pay the price would be that God intervened, and so he intervened, and he sent his only son into the world. Can you see what you're pecking at before you get very, very far down in cause and effect ways of understanding who God is and what he's about? Okay, so here we had, you know, the... let me read one more quote. Christian ministry, a guy by the name of John Beersdorf of Michigan. It's a Christian Century Foundation journal that comes out. I ran across this quote. He's talking about problems in ministry, okay, coming from another completely different kind of space. Another chronic difficulty centers on the problematic status of religious experience in the world of Newtonian mechanics and Freudian hydraulics. Ding, ding, ding. Here's somebody else talking about Sir Isaac Newton and him being outdated and some other things happening, you know.
Last question?
No, I'm stretching.
Okay, we'll stretch anytime. In relation to both difficulties, it's useful to know that modern particle subatomic physics metaphors for understanding reality, which are quite different from those of Newton, and in part include the older physics as special cases within a more complex understanding of nature and the universe. When I go that fast, it's not important. That new understanding is more compatible with reports through the ages of religious experience. Now, this gets important. So much so, in fact, that when a compilation of statements by subatomic physicists, mystics, and mediums was put together, persons were unable to identify which statements came from which groups. Even graduate students in physics couldn't tell. Okay?
So what's going to be happening, like in the future type thing of how things are going to go?
Okay, well, we're finding out, that's what I mean by something's going on. Okay? And you're hearing it, and you're finding points of crossover and come together from mystics, mediums, physicists, electronic engineers, some theologian, you know.
And they're all pointing to the same thing.
And it looks like they're moving toward the point of intersect. John?
There's a tape in the tape library by Walter Capps called The Second Revolution, if any of you want to listen. It's very similar to what Jim has just covered. And this is 2 years ago here at Holden. And he says there's a revolution going on and says the only way you can talk about it is just to use some descriptive words, because we can't really talk about it in the same way we could talk about another revolution. And he uses phrases, it's more intuitive than rational. It's more feminine than masculine. It's more Native American than the Western settlers who came. It's more circle than square. And over again, he's trying to describe this, and he talks for about 30 or 40 minutes about this revolution, and says, even as I'm talking, you say, I don't follow you. That means you have an assumption that there's point A to B, C, D, line, and if you can go back to B, it all follows. He says, that's the revolution, is that's the way we think now, and if you're talking about another way of thinking, it's very hard even to ask a question. He talks for about half an hour, 45 minutes. I asked people who had been at Holden, people my age said, I don't know what he was talking about, he wasn't very good. And young people in the 20s were just aglow. And I had yet to find a middle-aged male who thought he had anything to say at all.
Yeah.
I think it was very significant how people heard him. I think the way common people heard Jesus gladly, part of the thing is only the people who know what's going on and maybe for whom the something's going on is liberation. There's a way in which I'm part of what I hear, even on whether or not, if I know what's going on and it's threatening, I have defense mechanisms.
Yeah.
And if I can sense that it's good news, I perk up. But the people who don't even know what's going on can't even understand.
Can't even relate to it.
So it's very difficult. But that's a good, after this morning, if sometime you want to hear another person, you say it's coming from all over.
Yeah.
Walter Capps teaches at Santa Barbara. He studies monasteries all over the world. Has another tape on Thomas Merton, but the Second Revolution is very much like we just did.
Okay, put that down in your, if you're taking notes, put it down in the back of your head someplace if you're registering stuff there. What John is suggesting is that what you begin to develop once you become sensitive to the fact that something's going on is that you begin to look for it and you begin to develop a new set of eyeballs, or it's almost as if you got another eye growing up here. All of a sudden the paper looks different to you on Sunday or Monday or whenever you read it. You see the newscast different. All of a sudden you start to see stuff pointing. And sometimes even what looks bad or scares the hell out of you, you can see as a piece of that, you know, and you suddenly realize.
Now, what I'm suspecting and where I want to get around to, maybe tomorrow, hopefully get there, is that a lot of people know something's going on at B level instead of A level. Okay?
Exactly.
A level is what you know up here rationally, objectively. That's the itch you can't scratch, comes out of the B level. Okay? It's that thing that's happening down here that, you know, it's the people in this diagram. Let me get back here. Here, that the people here, it's a very similar to a Pontius Pilate Jesus thing, where Jesus stood before the crowd, you know, and Pilate was up there, and he said, "Now, you know, are you really the Son of God?" And he said, "Don't you know I have the power to kill you?" And I can, here's Pilate talking up here, you know, he's really running things. And Jesus down here, you know, with his hands tied in front of him, said, "You have no power. Mm-hmm. You haven't got any power. You got power." Pilate just said, "I got the power to kill you or keep you alive." And he says, "You have no power." And the message is starting to come through up here. Now you read about Iran, and you read about all in Mexico. And what you're hearing from Mexico, for example, when Carter went down there a few weeks ago was, "Go back home, Jimmy baby, because you have no power." Or, I cut a clipping out the other day. 21-year-old American woman who has lived in Iran for 5 months was strolling through the heart of the capital Saturday morning with two friends. As is her custom, she wore dark glasses to hide her most un-Iranian blue eyes. That's scary stuff. You have no power. Whichever side of the Iranian thing, I don't want to get into that kind of a discussion, but what I'm saying is that whether it's in the third world now, and this gets more on a global scale, or even in our own culture, the message is starting to come through, and it's causing, particularly in these levels, I think right now, a great deal of discomfort. And once you develop that kind of an eyeball, you know, the Bible passage which says, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit has to say to the churches," but you, down deep inside, you desperately wish you didn't know what you knew. Okay? The itch you can't scratch. You wish you didn't have that. We could go on with our beer and television, or Dome Stadium, or whatever it takes to consume.
So it's happening on every level, this change and this reevaluation.
I think so.
Global.
Yeah.
And then from there right on down to family structure and the whole bit.
I think so. I think a lot of family structures have been built on some pretty shaky basis in the past, and suddenly the truth and the reality of it, if it's coming to the surface, and that's why they're falling apart. Yes.
Well, is this, everything you say is changing, there's something going on. Is that because of an awareness that people are getting now, or is it just, it's going to happen regardless? I mean, because you say, you know, this discomfort, they're getting through that section of people, they're really starting to feel it. But is it because they know it's there, is it an awareness, or is it just because it's going to happen?
There's a couple, you know, I won't try to give you a straight yes or no answer, or it's this or that, but there are those who, in some of the stuff that Harmon's written, he even talks about a school of thought, and it's pretty, been some substantiation of that we're even going through an evolutionary period in the development of human development. In terms of even the development of parts of our brain we haven't used before. We got stuff working for us, abilities to perceive some kinds of things we may not have had before. So that when we talk about, if you watch that show on TV that was done by NBC, somebody mentioned, did you mention it last night? That had to do with, even had to do with supernatural kinds of activity, which we sort of poo-pooed, you know, in the church, saying, you know, that's witchcraft or that's something else or that's something else. This kid in Japan, you know, could take the pictures, yeah, and develop onto a film. He could image a thing downtown and zap it onto that. Well, when we called the guy who produced the film in New York, he said, we couldn't put this on here, he said, but his mother has a terrible time with him, because they were over in Japan did the filming. And he said, she has a terrible time with him because he's lost 3 bicycles. And he said, what do you mean by that? And she said, he said, well, he'll ride his bike to school, and he's too lazy to pump home, so he'll do a dematerialization process and show up at home, leave his bike there, somebody steals it, and he's lost 3 bicycles. And she said, you know, Johnny or whatever your name is.
He shows up at home then?
Yeah, he could do that. Yeah, they didn't do that on the TV thing. So that.
So the little town wreck is just a real toy. I mean, that's just small potatoes.
Well, yeah, but it's somebody, you know, you're hearing more about this kind of stuff from all places, too, if you really start reading.
Like standing an egg up on the
eagle. Well, but you know, if you listen to a guy like Copper long enough, and if you listen to the rules of what they're dealing with in subatomic theory and quantum theory, they're talking about the nature of substance and what it is and what it isn't. Let me quote to you from, we had Copper come back. In fact, we got Copper and we got Harmon and we got Deloria all together at a conference last December. Plus a woman theologian, so we had a female input and a theological input and a Native American input. This is a quote from Copper's paper that he gave to us at the ALC conference. Another important insight of atomic physics has been the realization that the cosmic web of relations, and he's talking about the, let me go back to the, quantum theory thus reveals a basic oneness of the universe. It shows that we cannot decompose the world into independently existing smallest units. As we penetrate into matter, nature does not show us any isolated building blocks. Now, when you talk about the kid in Japan dematerializing, well, look at the Bible. Look at Jesus going through a wall and coming into another room and all that kind of stuff. Look at the Bible. It's full of this kind of stuff if you start reading the Bible differently and believing it. But rather appears, there aren't any basic building blocks, but it rather appears as a complicated web of relations between the various parts of the unified whole. So that what actually stuff is made out of is relations. Yeah, and it's all in motion. It's this. Let me go further. Another important insight of atomic physics has been the realization that this cosmic web of relations includes the human observer and his or her consciousness in an essential way, so that even a piece of the reality is the consciousness itself. I we're getting into some deeper stuff here, but I...
Gary Bornson last fall lectured from the viewpoint of the new physics,
mm-hmm.
and the way he just said that was helpful for me. It used to be that you would start with analysis and then do reflection and then come to a conclusion.
Yep.
And you can't, there isn't anything like pure analysis. So you bring the observer determines part of what he sees and reports. And you can't have any pure observation that's not
right.
Partly determined by the one who is observing. That's saying a
precisely.
Somewhat similar thing, anyway.
Yeah, it's precisely what's going on. Let me finish this quote, Jim, and I'll come back to you so we get it all. In quantum theory, the observed objects, and this is what you're referring to, John, can only be understood in terms of the interaction between various processes of observation and measurement. At the end of this chain of process lies always the consciousness of the human observer. The crucial feature in quantum theory is that the human observer is not only necessary to observe the properties of an atomic phenomenon, but it's necessary even to bring about these properties. You start talking about faith moving mountains, you know, and that sort of stuff. Not too far off. Or the physicist, when he was sort of... Fritjof is a Roman Catholic, and he sort of left that European Roman Catholicism behind because it was pretty rigid. But when we said, yes, even the rocks shall cry out, he said, where's that? Where's that in the Bible? You know, he wanted to know because, you know, literally in his mind, it's alive. It's interconnected. And as the Indian talked, as Vine Deloria talked, he said, yes, the family gets larger and larger. we're talking about animals and trees and rocks and the interconnectedness of all of the creation and how we are part of that. Now, my conscious decision about how to observe, say, an electron will determine the electron's properties to some extent. In other words, the electron does not have objective properties independent of my mind. Yes?
It will determine my perception of the electron's properties, right? Which is, it looks to me like its properties. But it's not an objective property that's determined. I mean, it's a...
No, well, he would say that if you observe atomic... if you observe these properties, okay, an electron,
yeah,
and you look for a wave or an electron to come out of a reaction, whatever you're looking for, it'll take that on.
Yeah, but it's really your perception of it. I mean, it...
Well, okay, if you're objective,
yeah,
I guess you could
well,
say
someone
that.
Someone else won't see it.
Differently,
see
yes,
it,
that's what he would say, yeah,
yeah.
He would say someone else would see it differently.
It takes that on, but it takes that on as I'm seeing it. It doesn't, it's not an object, it's not, take, doesn't take it on from an objective viewpoint. Right?
That's true. How could the banner behind the blackboard, how could we all bring our objectivity to that? No. Our subjectivity? And, I mean, I would describe that banner as being purple, yellow, green, having a black cross, etc. If that, but that means everybody is perceiving that differently?
But that's funny. I've got a son who, when he see, when I see green, he sees brown. So I don't know if your yellow is the same as my yellow, etc. But we may be, you know, I'm not sure how all that goes together. It's motion, you know. The split, his point, let me, I don't want to get caught in the intricacies of atomic physics because I don't know enough about it. That's why I'm quoting like mad here, to give you a feel. The sharp Cartesian split, okay, in other words, the electron does not have objective properties independent of my mind.
Okay, yeah.
That's his point.
Yeah.
I don't think we buy
yeah.
that. Yeah, I don't. I mean, I think you're arguing against it. And
well, I'm just trying to clarify it. Yeah, I don't know if I buy it or not.
Yeah,
okay. In atomic, let's see. In atomic physics, the sharp Cartesian split between mind and matter, between I and the world, is no longer valid. We can never speak about nature without the same time speaking about ourselves. Then he goes on to deal with relativity and so on. The point I wanted to make there was the idea that consciousness is as much a piece of reality as, you know, that and affects, has its effect upon all of that. Yeah, Jim.
I remember the simply put question by some ancient philosopher, and it was my freshman year of college, I think, the question was, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it,
yeah,
does it make a noise?
Uh-huh.
Only the listener makes the noise happen. Otherwise, it falls in silence. Is that what you're saying?
Well, my perception of this is even... even beyond that, my point of application to it, so I begin to start to see through it, you know, struggle my way through what he's talking about here when I talk about prayer. Well, I can understand that a little bit. The kind of consciousness that comes about through prayer, meditation, those kinds of things.
An example of this kind of thing would it be like in prayer, you're praying when you're praying for healing for someone, and people will say, you, as you pray for healing, you, the objective, what we see, what we think is objective, is that the person may have some kind of disease, sickness, or whatever. They say, you don't concentrate on that, what we objectively think is the reality of the disease. As you pray, you see them whole and perfect. I mean, you pray, and what your perception is, even though it doesn't look like that to us, is that they're whole and perfect, and as you pray and see this, that this can help affect healing.
Okay, the healing issue is a very important issue, and one of the most threatening sciences that we have in our culture today by all of this kind of talk is medicine, because of the healing aspects that are involved. Nancy Van Dyke, who's a senior seminarian now at PLTS down in California, and is one of the Prober people, she did one of the papers she did for us was on active imagination, and she works with terminal children, cancer patients right now. She did a lot during her internship. If you understand anything about active imagination, it's through the imaging process. You can image the disease within yourself and, you know, work that whole thing out through a process of meditation. Call it prayer, call it what you want. But there have been some fantastic kinds of healing taking place. Some of the people we talked to and listened to lectures by, I mean, we're right there and listened to the lectures, and we even got tapes on. We heard Jonas Salk do some lectures down in San Diego. Two of us went down there to hear him. We heard George Leonard. He did such books as Education and Ecstasy. He was editor of Look magazine for about 17 years and has gotten into this sort of stuff. Rick Carlson, he's an old St. Olaf grad. He's a senior research associate for the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Science. We talked to Yuri Geller after he gave a lecture and bent some spoons and fixed Sally's watch. That had been sitting 2 years in her dresser drawer back home, and she didn't know he fixed watches, and we went home, the darn thing was running in her dresser drawer, you know, it was crazy.
Did that make you a believer?
No.
We laughed all the way home. He said, you know, if we'd known he fixed watches, my old watch in the dresser drawer, you know, would have been fixed. And he had said, you may have a broken watch at home that's working too, you know, when you leave. And I said, then we walked in the house, and I made a beeline for a dresser drawer, and I pulled it open, and I looked down at it. And
I had a lot of reservations about that.
Really funny.
Is there a guy that comes to the medical school in Minnesota, and the film projectors all go on the blink while he's there? Or
yeah, that's happened.
Say?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But then we had a Lutheran pastor in who was a healer, you know, had quite a lot of experience. We started checking out a lot of paranormal kinds of stuff.
Who was that?
Torgerson, Lowell Torgerson, used to be out in California.
Community,
yeah.
Side,
yeah, and he's got some, prints of his hand before, during and after prayer and all that sort of stuff, and the radiation and stuff around his fingers. We started looking at some of the Eastern religion kind of stuff that had to do with mantras and centers, with the seven points within the body, chakras, and centers of energy, and all, you know, it gets really weird and spooky, and I don't talk about this stuff too much out in the, you were saying I get in trouble for worrying around with sex, boy, wait till this gets out, you know, that we're raising some questions, or at least listening, you know, trying to understand.
We got you on tape now.
My name's John Schramm. But then we talked, a very interesting thing was, it had to do for a global significance, some of this, is that got to be good friends of Stuart Kingma and Anita Barrow, who are the co-directors of the Christian Medical Commission of the World Council of Churches, who are running medical programs in about 90-some foreign countries through the World Council of Churches. They even held a conference with the World Health Organization on... what they call native medicine, you know, primitive medicine, because they found out that the American medical model just simply doesn't fit in about 80% of the world. Does not fit, and, you know, the cause of disease and how it's done, how it takes care, and some of the most helpful people that they've had, for example, are the quote-unquote witch doctors, in terms of, you know, we expect they're on a broomstick and are calling the devil down, or whatever it is or means, but they're very important sources of health and care. So these kinds of people, whether it was from establishment to non-establishment, to from Sufi healers to, you know, professional experts, whatever it was,
And there are people within the medical profession, some of the things you listed, that are open to this and doing the investigation.
Yes.
Me, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Very frankly, people's credibility is partly dependent upon who you're quoting. Whether that's,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure that's always.
Well, that's why I quote so many, because people usually don't believe me. I haven't done anything.
Right.
Yeah. I said I was going to tell you a story, and what I'm telling you about right now is what's happening to me, okay? And what I'm struggling with. And so what I hope to do here, I guess, is to invite you to join in the fun of it, and the search of it, and the scariness of it, because I want to talk about that too. Because I can't forget, I'm locked in here pretty much.
So what shake, if there's something going on and it's shaky, most of us are in the part that's going to get shook.
That was some of the conclusions that we came to.
Excuse me, when you started off by saying that the bottom group, the 15, the poor, and the 2% at the top, they're the only ones that really know what's going on. So that bottom group has more of a chance to give, they have nothing to lose, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
They have a much better chance to embrace all of this stuff and sort of
be open
to it than any of us do.
But for example, in the health field, it will not be too long if we have an economic bust. And I got a quote there someplace in the Minneapolis paper saying anybody who looks to the economic forecast of our country in the future is crazy. You know, there's no optimism there to be seen. That if that happens, for example, when it comes to the whole business of health care, we're going to be out of luck. Or the need for medical intervention. We simply won't be able to afford it. We don't have the economics to back us up, or the kind of insurance and reinsurance. That whole thing will go down the tubes all at one time. But these people, I went to stay with a family for a couple of days in a migrant camp down in Florida, migrant workers. And Mrs. Hernandez was my hostess. And in the morning, we went out and walked in her yard. And, you know, she had medicine for that, and that, and that, and that. It was all grown in her yard. She knew how to survive without a lot of stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was having other hassles in her life, with racial strife going on in the camp between the blacks and the Chicanos, but she at least knew how to deal with some of that stuff. She couldn't afford a doctor. No way she could have a doctor come out there.
Like, things are going to get back to simplest forms. I mean, all this, it's just so highly technical and so advanced, it's always just going to be kind of tumbling down. And like I said, what the Indian is saying and what all these people are saying, and they're all coming, they're all pointing to one thing, but that whole thing is more of a simplified, simplistic.
Yeah. The thing that, not only is something going on, not only is it spiritual in nature and somehow relates to the development of the human potential stuff, active imagination, all of that, but also to the human liberation and social justice struggles. It's all a part of the same thing, you see. That's what I meant by these social justice struggles, human liberation struggles, etc. They're all a piece. They're all a piece of the same stuff. They're all part of the same struggles moving this way.
I missed that when you did that. I'm glad you mentioned that now. What were the arrows, the up movement and the down arrow?
Well, where I was trying to suggest where the struggle probably ought best be. And I think we waste a lot of energy struggling against each other. The person over here interested in racism doesn't have much time, oftentimes, for the person over here dealing with active imagination or cancer. Saying, hell, that's, you know, you just got your nose in your navel. What are you doing that for? I'm over here dealing with the real tough stuff. I'm dealing with the political, social reality. And I think that's a mistake. I think we ought to give people their space, but we also have to help people understand. We have to make some announcements about the fact that we are indeed interconnected, a la Fritjof Capra.
And so we, what we ought to be doing, spending our energy,
working together.
Up everybody with the forces, the principalities and powers, right?
Right, I really think that's kind of it. The principalities, the powers of death, the powers of darkness.
Sounds like Yoda.
Yeah, they come down.
That's
where we're at.
Was it? Sure.
Well, great minds are on the same channel. Oh, that's a compliment, John. Thank you. But that, you know, that's kind of it for me. Now, another thing that I want to say, yet we got 4 minutes. Want to make 2 points yet to leave, just to break it off today. One is that whatever this movement is about, whatever this thing that's going on is about, is that I understand it, I see it, and you may have different ideas. We can talk about that tomorrow more. I see it as counterculture. Okay? That the idea is that the cultural stream, you know, is running this direction and running swift and rapidly, and we're kind of caught up in it and being carried along, you know, right down the stream, and it's just pushing us, carrying it on our way. And we're trapped, we're literally trapped. I don't really see a way out unless, and I think this in the 60s, we saw a lot of people just simply get up on a bank and drop out. And I, as much as that's a temptation, and maybe a way to start, I don't know. But what I see this movement to be is counterculture in the sense that we turn around in the middle of that stream, at least turn around and face it. Mm-hmm. Now, that's tough. To me, this is another word. The word to turn around is another word for repentance. Okay? To repent means to turn around. And when you turn around, the minute you turn around in the middle of that cultural stream, I think we begin to understand what it means to take up the cross and follow.
To admit your mistake.
Huh?
To admit your mistake. That all.
Yeah.
It means to repent. It means to stand there. Now, this is tough. I've got friends, and sometime I'm among them. When all of a sudden I find myself in the midst of that flow, and Jim, whether it's, you know, the church president or whoever it is or the people that write letters, literally it makes brave men and women cry. I'm going to do it now. It's tough. It's trapped. Because I got a friend who wrote a book and laid it out, who wakes up at 5 in the morning because you're caught. And, you know, it's caught and it's not caught, okay? But the hope then, okay, the hope then lies in the realization that God's kingdom is coming. And it comes, as Luther said, it comes indeed without our prayer. And what that means to me is that by God, we're not in charge of it. Okay? We're not in charge of the kingdom of God. And as Luther goes on with that little meaning in the Lord's Prayer, he said, we only hope we can get a little piece of it when it goes by. To point to it, to testify to it, to say, hey, there it is. Or it's here, it's there. And John, you read the poem by Jim Carroll, you know. It's the kind of craziness theologians call grace, you know? Then it lets you be in here, and at times, you know, you'll find yourself, you're back, taking a deep breath and letting the culture carry you. And it's not an easy place to be. Now, the fact that God's kingdom does come, and it does come indeed without our prayer, the fact that something is going on, I think, let me read you one last little paragraph here and then we'll quit, that came out of some of the conclusions of our group. We knew we weren't in charge of it. We knew we weren't going to change the world a whole lot. It was already changing and we were being changed. And I think it's happening to everybody. We're all being changed. That's we're not in charge of that very much. Okay. Culturally, we see ahead the potential of a societal convulsion that could be on the order of a grand climacteric with some fateful consequences. Could be bloody, what I'm saying.
And this will probably happen when the controllers become aware of their own death rattles. He's up on top, when they can't adjust anymore. When they finally hear the message, you have no power, and it starts to sink in. And it's starting to sink in when we realize, as anybody born in 1930 on has watched us use up 80% of the fossil fuel on this planet, you know? That's what Mo Udall told us in Washington last week. And they start to grab for straws, and when they do, the straws are going to be straw. And some way, somehow, the fact that that's probably going to be the way it's going to be, it's the best I can tell. Some way, somehow, we need to understand that as the gospel. Okay? And that's the gospel message for the day. That we're going to be stopped. And as no way I can see anything, and for me, at least at this point, and everything I've been looking at and listening to, there's no way I can see how that won't have to happen if God's a God of justice on a global scale.
If God has what?
Is a God of justice. God of justice and a God of love. If God is alive and at work in God's world about the business of being God. So that's a faith statement. But the implications of it are a new understanding, perhaps, not such a new, but an old understanding, again, of the gospel, of what the good news is. That where stuff got out of sync and out of whack, God's at work to bring it back into balance. Yeah, Mary?
Jim, I just like to add to your illustration of turning around in the middle of the street. For me, the agony is...
Thanks, Barry. I think you said it. You know, we need to know, though.
It's being pushed backwards. I mean, you're not strong enough to turn around and beat the panel. So you're...
Yeah.
And so you need to continue.
Yeah. You need support. You need support in that thing. I used to do a little talk on God's happy salmon. That's the ones that are trying to work their way up their spawn.
That's much like the letter, first part. The letter from Merton to Jim Forrest, don't you think? That letter you read at the end of the Vespers last night? And last week, if you remember, John Howard Yoder, about 10 times what Jim erased off the board this morning were about 10 references to the cross. And finally, it is the price of social nonconformity. That's all it ever meant. And it's to be counterculture. It doesn't mean anything else in the New Testament. And that's the one place we're called to imitate Jesus. We're not called to imitate him in any other way. The way he dressed, that he was celibate, nothing. But every time it's to bear the cross of the price of social nonconformity against the powers, it says, be like Jesus.
And the threat to that, to nearly every institution we know, and even the ones we hold dear, even our church, is very, very great. Very great. Maybe our God's been too small. Time to break. We're 5 minutes past. Well, we can talk about this some more tomorrow and see where it takes us. Thank you.